Production. Recorded live.
Hey guys, this is Rick. Sorry about all of the confusion. Hopefully, we got that all straightened out right now. We forgot to get this one scheduled, so I am personally trying to handle it. That's always scary if you let me do it. But even without Aaron, we have done our best. Now, let's look here. Oh, we've even got people logging on to the program I set up while I'm lonesome. That's amazing. So it's the 10th, and we're here at 12:45 today because I've got some meat with 8 minutes, so I'm kind of quick on some of these answers for you. We should have more time. Good text, bad text. You often talk about bad text and good text. Can you give a definition of each and what's the difference? And I don't say bad text. I'm just saying basically what was established in terms of our motivations and our reasons for being sexual outside of marriage versus inside of marriage. And so bad sex, one of the interesting components to kind of pre-commitment sorts of sexual activities, two of the biggest psychological arousal factors are anxiety and guilt. Many people, especially if they feel like they should be holding off until marriage before they're sexual, what will happen is there's guilt and anxiety, which actually doing the wrong thing is quite a motivator or quite a psychological arousal factor. So there's a whole lot of arousal and excitement and extra marital sorts of activities, whether it's, you know, before you ever get married or even while you're married and with something that's non-marital sex, because that's always driven by the guilt, the anxiety, and also the wanting what you don't have. Good sex or marital sex is what I'm referring to as I kind of make the little play on words there, is about oneness, and it's about a very different experience. It's not about necessarily the sexual high. It's about connection. And so while one of those drives, what I would call the marital sex or the good sex, is while it's about connection and oneness, the other one is actually about orgasms and sexual arousal and feelings and intensity and some things like that. So those are why we begin to delineate. And there's totally different belief systems and totally different motivational systems that influence those. And so those two paradigms are really important as you begin to work on the marriage, and hopefully that helps a little bit. My husband had a pornography addiction for 10 years, and he started an affair when we first met 4 years ago. He exchanged many passionate emails and had cyber sex often with her in between when they could meet. Would you consider this a limerent affair within a sexual addiction? Is there any explanation for exchanging passionate words and saying he wished he could leave me to be with her because he was in love with her and never me? He also told his best friend this, not just her. So in answer to your first part, is it possible to have a limerent affair, for a sex addict to have a limerent affair? It is possible. I mean, I'm a sex addict that ended up having a limerent affair, so I do know that that can occur. Frequently, a sexual addiction can allow you, continually puts you into situations, and eventually that whole connection mechanism, the desire for something beyond just anonymous sex or the orgasm, the desire for connection can occur, and so that sort of relationship can happen, but it's dangerous or difficult to know because so frequently people who are sex addicts will tell the other person anything they want to hear for the sake of getting what they want, when in reality they don't really care about the other person at all. In fact, I would dare say in sexual addiction it's difficult, period, to honestly care about another person because there's such an intense drive to make the connection to get the high. So I don't know Was he in love with her and never me? I would say, in answer to that, I don't know enough about your circumstance, but I will say the black and white aspect that you make of this, in love with her and never me, it's not that simple. I can promise you if he had feelings for her, he probably also had really strong feelings for you. In fact, one aspect of sex addicts is they never really want to leave, or typically, is they don't really want to leave their relationship. They just want to be able, you know, they've always acted out. They just added to their sexual repertoire. So now they've got their good sex, their bad sex. They're just running two lives down the same course, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't care for you. I found that my husband had a passionate, lustful affair with another woman since the beginning of our marriage. He's remorseful and seeking help. I know I'm supposed to wait a year before making a decision to divorce. Is it possible that I can forgive him, but, that I can forgive him but still want a divorce, even if he never did this to me again? Absolutely. What he did already has wounded me so deeply, I don't think I can stay married to him, nor do I feel I want to stay married to him. My family would actually be disappointed if I divorced him after his demonstration of remorse, commitment to recovery, and many women stay with their husband after they've had an affair. Does it make me heartless and cold to want a divorce? Will I be able to heal, forgive, and still decide to divorce? The answer to that is absolutely. I just think that, and I don't know exactly how close you are to ground zero, but frequently when someone is very close, where the emotions are really intense, they don't feel that there's any way that there could be anything different in terms of how they feel. And while there may not be, and you'll know, even if you forgive him and you're able to let go and he continues his path, you may still not have it in you, which I understand. I just know that trying to make that decision when you're still in the midst of the initial crisis of revelation, when there's all that instability and pain and confusion and you haven't gotten your mind fully around it yet, that's not the time, in my mind, to be making the decision. That's why we recommend that you wait a period of time. First off, not only to see what, you know, he may or may not do, but second off, for you to kind of get beyond that initial reaction stage, grieve what is, so that you can gain perspective and decide ultimately what you want. As I always say, you know, having traded in the stock market before, you don't want to be making emotional decisions when you're buying and selling stock, just because there's just no sense of objectivity. And you never know what your heart's going to do. I mean, I've had many people tell me that, for instance, they've lost all feeling for their mate. No attraction, no desire, no feelings for them. And over time, as we dealt with the resentments, we dealt with the hurt, we help them disconnect from where they were previously, they find that they have a tremendous amount of passion once again for their mate. So for that reason, I just say, look, I recommend not making a decision for a season. And usually we say a year. And at the end of that, if you still want out, absolutely, you'd certainly be able to get out. And I've had people who have done that. So I think you'll know clearly what works for you and what doesn't work for you by the time you get to that point. Let's see, next question here. Can you give the main differences between lust and limerence? They both seem passion-based with uncontrolled emotions to have the other person sexually. What are the main character differences between the two, if any? The dictionary defines lust as infatuation, and I thought limerence was infatuation. Husband had an affair with the same woman for 4 years. If he's a sex addict, wouldn't he have changed partners instead of getting into a passionate long-term relationship? No, actually, lust and limerence are probably, I would say lust is a little bit bigger than limerence. I mean, from a almost a moral or kind of a, how we define lust. I'm sorry, what? I would just say that lust is a lot more than just being connected with another person. And so someone can probably look at another person and kind of lust after them in a sense, want to use them, objectify them. We would say that would be lust. But that doesn't mean that they have this kind of relationship addiction. There's another term that sometimes is used, it's called a love addict. And the love addict, some of those relationships may last 4, 5, 6 years before they go to the next one. But what they're always seeking is that next high. At the risk of not knowing her, and somebody I've always wondered if they may not have had this, would have been somebody like Elizabeth Taylor, who went from relationship to relationship. And you may know other people have done this. That's the first one that just popped in my mind. But where it was, I think it was about the feeling in love and the loving that it kind of the fresh newness that came from it. So some of those relationships lasted several years before, you know, it wore out. Donald Joy's work shows that limerence can last, that initial infatuation, up to 4 years. Some people say that it can't last longer than 2 to 3. So once someone, though, has that sort of, if they're looking for the feeling that comes more from the relational aspect of it at that point, then that sort of thing can last several years. And they wouldn't necessarily be going on from person to person. The drug is more about the limerence piece, not just the sex piece. Let's see. Is it normal for a sex addict to have same as follow-up? Is it normal to have a long-term relationship? Isn't it more characteristic to have no emotional attachment? And so back to the thing I just was saying, that it really depends on what a person, kind of what they're drawing, what the kind of chemical high they're getting from it, what someone is actually seeking. And Elizabeth Taylor is seeking, I think, more the relational piece of how it makes them feel. It makes them feel loved and adored, and if they could be with this person, blah, 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 it would be incredible. But in reality, that's just magical thinking. Nobody could ever really fix our problems in the long run. They're not, you know, Stephanie is not the solution to my problems. And she's really not even the source of my problems. I mean, Stephanie's, she's wonderful. Sometimes she's difficult. But it's really about how do I respond to difficult situations, and do I love her, and have I figured out ultimately how to enjoy her, regardless of where she's at any given time. I mean, I'm the one that controls my attitude. And so in the long run, I think that if you think of sex addiction just as, you know, looking at pornography and pure numbers, then I think you probably are just looking at a very small slice of it. And I'm running a unfaithful women's group right now. And in the women's group, almost every one of them was in a long-term kind of a love addiction sort of situation. But what they were seeking certainly was not sex. What they were seeking was what they got, how that relationship ultimately made them feel about themselves. Patterns in sexual addiction. Let's see. Same follow-up. Husband and affair partner used to alternate when they would meet, and they would either rush to have sex or masturbate? Have you heard of this before? Why would you not have sex every time? She wanted to, but he seemed to be in control of what they did. He has pornography and masturbation addiction. Could it be related to that? Absolutely. Different people find different things erotic. So some people, this is a huge question, but what is in somebody's arousal template or in their eroticism template is vastly different. So what people are looking for, even when they're being sexual, there are different sorts of meanings. Sometimes when someone just does masturbation in front of another person, they're playing kind of the mortal versus venial sin card, which is it feels less bad to masturbate than it does to actually have intercourse. So it would be a mortal sin to have intercourse. It would be just sort of a venial sin to have to just masturbate in front of somebody. Sometimes it's certainly, when you describe a situation like that, and this would be very indicative of an addict, it's not about what the other person wants. Ultimately, it's still about what the addict wants and how I can use you to best satisfy the itch that I need to scratch at that moment. And that's pretty much all I see there, is he's scratching the itch in the way that would work best for him at that point in time to scratch that itch. Let's see. Can you explain preoccupation? My husband usually told his affair partner he would be in town at least a month in advance. Is it true that he's preoccupied with acting out up until he saw her? Does preoccupation mean fantasizing about acting out, planning? The preoccupation is really... In sexual addiction, in the cycle, is that stage by, you're always, I call it living in the bubble. What you're doing is anticipating, or you're preoccupied with how you're going to set up the next time you get to be with that person or the next opportunity that you're going to get to act out. The problem is, it's like if you've got point A here and the next acting out is in point B, they become preoccupied with getting to point B so that they miss basically everything that happens in between point A and point B, because their focus isn't about what's occurring in life. Their focus is point B. And so that's why for the addict, and we call that living in the bubble, they don't even get to experience life, because the vast are potentially the majority of their thought life, instead of being focused on life, is focused on the next time they get to act out. So they basically miss life, and that's the preoccupation. You're just focused on how you're going to get there, how you're going to keep it secret, running different scenarios. And the preoccupation, even thinking about it, and the build-up phase for many people is as much a bad kind of high. It's a way of extending kind of the addictive cycle, or extending kind of the high, because every time they think about it, they work on it, they contemplate it, they fantasize about it, they're releasing all the drugs that are associated with their sexual addiction. So the preoccupation just becomes a way of kind of drug dosing in some ways and just doing the addiction. And, planning even a month in advance, that would be really common. But it doesn't mean necessarily fantasizing. It can have a lot to do with planning and making sure you've thought of all the details. But it can also have some aspects of fantasizing about it, or daydreaming about it. So that can be also a part of the preoccupation. Lust. So this is good. How would you define lust, passion, infatuation, yearning, intense sexual arousal, and desire? Is lust always bad? Can you have lust for someone you love too? What is the lust lizard? I keep looking for it on ARC because members have told me about it, but I can't find it. Okay, so the story of the lust lizard is actually from EMS, and it's a part of the EMS program. And it's actually taken from a piece written by C.S. Lewis in The Great Divorce. And I can't quote the page number for you, but if you got The Great Divorce, it'd be a good read for you. But it's about a guy that actually has a lizard on his shoulder as he goes up to visit heaven from hell. That's the whole piece of that story. So if you get a chance to read The Great Divorce, I think you could find that particular aspect of the story. Is lust always bad? It really depends a lot on how you define lust. The problem with the way I define lust, which would be lust is a sexual desire void, I think, of a selfless love. It's a selfish love. It's erotic in nature. And there's been writings about the four different types of love. There's Eros, which is kind of a selfish love. It's about my self-satisfaction, but using you as a way of getting that. Storge, which is a family love. Philos, which is friendship love. And Agape, which is a selfless love. The problem with lust is you're looking at another person basically as the solution. It's almost like an objectification or using them as a way to get, just using them basically for your own high, your own gratification. And so the problem in that is that it's really not about concern or love for the other person. It's really about what I get back. I mean, I may, it's almost like an appetite. Is lust bad? Certainly in my mind, I don't want to objectify people and use them as an object for my own gratification. So I usually put, I really don't want to be into lust. I'd really like to be able to see people as people, not as objects that are there for my own use. So I try as best I can to see people in a bigger framework than lust. Okay. What's the best way to handle an incident where a spouse ends up acting out? There have been a few incidences when we started things and it ended up with the feeling of him changing in the middle and ending it with acting out sexually. Is it stop? Is it best to stop and be honest and just say that you feel a change and that you feel he's acting out? Now, that's a little bit in code. So I'm going to say what I'm going to clarify this a little bit, and I'm not sure that I'm clarifying this the right way. And then I'm going to give you another way of considering acting out. So what's the best way to handle an incident where a spouse ends up acting out? There have been a few incidents when we started things and it's ended up with a feeling of him changing in the middle and ending it with acting out sexually. Is it best to stop and be honest and just say you feel the change? So I'm assuming that this person is talking about being sexual. And what's happening is they're coming together sexually. I don't know if that's the case. I'll make that assumption in answering this question. If I'm wrong, please forgive me. But I'm just, that's only kind of the way I can kind of see it at the second. And so in many ways, if you think of acting out And I'm not quite sure how you define that, but I'll either, with my emotions, express my emotions, be honest and authentic about where I'm at, kind of let other people see that, or I'll act out where I'm at, or I'll act out my emotions. I'll either be able to walk in the light and be authentic, or I'll act that out in another way. So if you're in the middle of, like, being sexual and it feels like there's a disconnection that begins and that maybe he's gone into fantasy or something like that, at least I can use that as an example, then you probably could say that he's acting out something that doesn't involve you anymore. I mean, his ability to be connected with you at that moment, he's not being connected, instead he's acting out something different rather than being present with you in an enactment of what's happening at that moment. And yes, the best thing is to stop and be honest and say that you just felt a change. And rather than just say you feel he's acting out, I would actually ask the question. I'd say, what just happened? Can you be honest with me about where you just went? Or what are you feeling? And hopefully, just that question, at the very least, the question itself stops. It brings everything back to the moment. It kind of breaks the spell. And, you know, I suggest to couples a lot of times that, you know, if they are being sexual and suddenly you feel kind of a disconnect, both directions, because it could be the hurt spouse has intrusive thoughts. Suddenly they're not present in the same way, because now they're kind of fighting this emotional flood, trying to figure out what to do with the emotions that were triggered. Or maybe they just got the intrusive thought trying to break through and they're seeing images of their mate with somebody different. And so at that moment, if you think about it, whatever they do from that point forward, they're actually acting out what's going on in their mind, rather than just being able to be present and connected with their mate in the moment. So whether it be the hurt spouse or the unfaithful spouse, the ability to stop and ask, where'd you just go? Is everything okay? Do you need to talk? Or if you're the person who just started getting the intrusive thoughts, or you're just struggling with staying present and staying available, I think it's very important at that point to stop and just let your mate know, I'm not in a really good place here for a second. Let's stop and get reconnected. And if you'll just stop and talk, and sometimes it doesn't even have to be like this huge disclosure of what's really going on. But it's really about just expressing a desire to want to be connected in the moment with that person and just saying, I'm just struggling with that. So let's talk and get... You know, you can talk about almost anything at that moment, but make eye contact and just slow down and then try to re-engage in a few minutes after the emotions have begun to kind of calm down and you feel kind of reconnected back with that other person. I think that's the best way to deal with that when it happens, but don't pretend it's not there. So, and I wouldn't say, and you feel like you're acting out. That's potentially going to make somebody defensive. That's why I'd say, or just say, you know, are you okay? It just feels like you just went somewhere. What's going on? Asking a question like that is a lot better than making a statement which might make somebody else defensive. Grieving, angry. If I seem to be grieving angry, is that not healthy? Many women cry a lot. I wish I could cry. I'm just hurt and angry. I feel the pain, but I can't cry. Am I not grieving healthy? Actually, it depends a lot on what you do with your anger. When anger becomes, if you act anger out in a way of trying to transmit pain to another person, then I would say that anger isn't a healthy anger. So I would certainly not recommend that. But if you can do anger in such a way where you're able to verbalize kind of what you're feeling, I think that's good. In the long run, though, I still think you want, once the anger begins to subside, and again, depending on how close you are to ground zero, I still think there's a place where you've got to deal with maybe some of the softer emotions about feeling abandoned and feeling really not wanted and feeling really misunderstood. There's other emotional loops in the healing of that relationship that have to happen and have to be grieved. And it's not all just about anger, I suspect. We always say anger is a secondary emotion. Underneath anger will be other things such as, you know, hurt or fear or guilt or trauma, maybe feeling really insignificant, the loss of dreams, and ultimately you have to be able to get to those things. I discovered my husband's infidelity about 9 months ago. Is it normal for a man not to want sex with his wife during his recovery, and what is my role in helping to heal, helping heal during this process? So in my opinion, it's very normal. It doesn't happen all the time. It's just not unheard of by any means. And it has a lot to do with oftentimes if someone has had a history of acting out sexually, they've never developed kind of an understanding of what healthy is. They don't want, intuitively, they don't want to act out or kind of be back in an old pattern, but they don't know or have yet to create the new pattern in their mind. They don't really know how to connect. They don't really know how to do a relationship. So when they cut off the old behavior, the old way of being sexual, it's like if they have yet to create a new way of understanding it, maybe a broader vision of what it's really about, then there's a season where there's not much of a desire because they don't know really what they'd be desiring. In other words, they haven't grown far enough where they've been able to delineate between what the extramarital sex or the addictive sex was about versus what marital sex is supposed to be about. Can you help in that process? Absolutely. The two of you being able to read materials together, I think, are really good. Frequently, I'll have people read things like Lehman's Sheet Music. I have a lot of couples. I got two or three couples right now that I've got doing Restoring the Pleasure by Penner and Penner. Because that's really about kind of almost, I call it reformatting the hard drive and coming up with a whole nother way of looking at it. And I just think that's an important aspect, another way of looking at it, or of developing a common understanding. And it also gives very specific exercises or kind of retraining exercises to expand what you ultimately see as intimacy. So in a situation like this, a lot of times, since there may just be one way of doing it in their mind, a lot of times I'll just kind of cut sex off completely, have people do Restoring the Pleasure so that we can begin to get a different viewpoint, and then try to grow something new from that point rather than just trying to tweak something that was old. Now, I want an entirely different paradigm to work from, and going through those exercises is helpful. My wife and I have been going through recovery since the day of discovery 7 months ago. We've gone to EMS, doing follow-ups. I'm attending 12-step meetings, and we're going to weekly counseling. We're reading books, all very intentional. There are times it feels like we're making great progress, and other times she is despairing. She despairs that she will not be happy again, or that she will never be able to love me again, or even respect me. I feel like I'm getting mixed messages because there are times I feel she's hopeful. And there probably are times, by the way, that she's incredibly hopeful. She won't say it, but I can feel it and deduce from what she occasionally asks me. Do you think we're going to make it? And I think she's looking to me to be consistent, to assure her that I'm going to hang in there. And I can guarantee you she's looking to that. She stated recently that she doesn't know anyone who says that their marriage is better or that they are happier after working through the affair. She believes that people just accept a tolerable existence in marriage and plod through life. You might have her read the newsletter. Never this last one, but there's many people that I can have her contact. Never experience real joy again. I understand her feelings in the now, but I don't believe that is true for people who've worked through the trauma and the affair. I believe that we can have a much better marriage than we had before. Could you tell me what is the likelihood that we will have a good or even better marriage if we work through this trauma? Is what she's feeling normal for our stage of recovery? Are there signs to look for and point to that would give her hope? Thank you. Okay. First off, one of the problems, not a problem, but it's one of the realities that when you're dealing with follow-up group from like EMS, and depending on kind of the people in that group, you've got people that are still probably still in pretty early in that recovery process. So those may not be the best ones to look to. If you know other people who've gone through it, but they haven't, I think, done a lot of the right things, they're going to not be great encouragers in that sense. Some people just have very hard relationships to begin with. So if she's interested in talking to people who think their marriage is much better, certainly, I think she could probably listen to almost any of the mentor couple recordings. I think that if she came to EMS, she knows me, Steph, and I feel like our marriage is a lot better. That's one. And I think there's a point of discouragement. Remember, I said in that first year, it's a little bit crazy. Most people don't really begin to hit a stride until, again, that 18 to 24-month period where they're kind of back more in a groove. There's still a lot of lability or a lot of fluctuations that ultimately happen early on. Signs to look for and to point to that would give her hope. The best sign to point to in right now would be your recovery process. If someone can see the work that their mate is doing and they see a consistency on their part in terms of their own pursuit for help, that alone is typically enough. That's the best indicator, first off, of what's going to happen with the relationship in the long run. Because if it starts with the person who's unfaithful, if they're not willing to do the necessary work for their own healing and able to kind of get a firm grasp on what their issue is and then a willingness to live life around that in order to keep their marriage safe over time, then, they don't need to be having hope, and most likely the relationship won't be better. But the other thing, this reason the relationship is better also in the long run, is if you do the work you need to do, your ability to relate to her on a I guess a deeper level in terms of authenticity, and instead of acting things out again, really just being able to be present and to be real, to have increased intimacy goes up dramatically. That's not to say, on the other hand, that she doesn't have to do her work. Most likely, the relationship had problems long before the infidelity. And each person, I think, learning to kind of follow the Lord, learning to their own kind of spiritual growth, learning to be focused on something other than their mate as the solution to their problem, kind of finding new purpose and new vision and new meaning. Those are all things that should be coming in the long run from this, maybe not in the first 12 months, but a new sense of purpose and a new sense of what we're going to be about go a long way to helping us like our relationship better. I mean, depending on what stage of life you're at, there are other reasons that make relationships, even besides the infidelity, appear hopeless. I mean, if you're at the stage where you're having babies, sometimes it may feel hopeless just because the amount of stress being put on the relationship as a result of new children. Or if you're at the leaving home stage, you've got, you know, other pieces that, you know, it's almost like that hope is partly created by a lack of vision. So the two of you working at developing vision also in the long run of where we're going to be is going to be an important piece. So signs, look to you. Maybe other signs to look to. Be sure to look at trending. You know, are things getting better over time? Are things better in month 7 than they were in month 1? That's oftentimes the easiest way to begin hope. Don't compare yourself against where you're at today. Compare yourself against where you're at here and see if you're trending better. If you're not trending better and there's not more connection and if things you haven't experienced new things, then there may not be hope. So it is now 12:45, so I've got to get to my next activity. I hope you guys have a great week, and I look forward to talking to you next Monday. God bless.